all of this stuff is trainable. The crazy thing is that almost no one trains it. Like in athletics, it'd be crazy if you like, oh, I know it's important to have good lungs, right? I'm playing basketball or something, but I don't train cardio. You know, like I don't try to do anything to make it better. And if you're a knowledge worker or you're a creative worker, I mean, concentrating on one thing is like your equivalent of having good cardiovascular health. It's like crucial to what you do, but we just think of it as like for some reason we think of focus as this like intrinsic trait that some people are just good at and other people aren't. And you're like, oh, I guess I'm not a focus person. That's like, if I went out and ran a mile, if I've never done any running, it would be wrong for me to conclude, oh, I'm not a running person. It would be, no, I'm not trained to run. I got to lace up the shoes.
Okay, welcome back, or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais, and by trade and training, I am a sport and performance psychologist. And the whole idea behind these conversations is to learn from people who have committed their life efforts towards mastery. And we want to understand the psychological components that have helped them become. How do they make sense of themselves? How do they make sense of the world around them? And how do they use their mind to build their skills required to perform and live well in modern life? And if you want to learn more about how you can train your mind, this is just a quick reminder to check out the online course that I created with head coach of the Seattle Seahawks, Pete Carroll, at findingmastery.net/course. And we took all the greatest gems from science, made it applied, all the stuff that we use in the real world to help world-class athletes, artists, musicians, whatever they might be, executives, kick ass in life, and of course, in business. Finding Mastery is brought to you by listening. This is exactly what their app does. It helps you listen to books and content that you might not be able to sit down and actually have the time to read. There was a time in early in my career where I remember sitting in the back hallways of my university and being in the library for hours, reading all of the sports psychology literature and research that I could get my hands on. I loved it. I cherished it. The field of sports psychology is just absolutely on a bender right now. It is growing so fast. It is nearly impossible to keep up with all of the research that's coming out. So that's why I love what listening is doing. It's a game changer for me. So the listening app, it lets me listen to anything that's in writing while I'm on the go. Everything from academic papers to books, PDFs, web pages, articles, anything that I put in their app, it reads it to me. It narrates to me. And plus their AI is great. The way that the interface sounds, like, of course, it's not a human that's reading, but it kind of, the AI is so good of what they're doing. It just works. And then there's also this note-taking function. They know that people like us like to take notes. And so it's as simple as when I hear a key idea, I instantly press a button and that section is saved. They've done a really nice job with this product and they've got a great offer for us. Usually they only give a 2-week trial, but because you are listening to Finding Mastery, you get a whole month for free. Check that out, a whole month for free. So I want to encourage you to go check it out. listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get started. Again, it's listening.com/findingmastery or use the code findingmastery at checkout to get 1 month completely free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Hims. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing simple, convenient, and affordable access to science-informed treatments for erectile dysfunction, known as ED. They also are servicing hair loss, weight loss, and more. Health struggles like ED, they're common, but they can be hard to talk about when it comes to finding a solution. That's why Hims has been a game changer for so many men. The entire process is 100% online. Answer a series of questions on their site, and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option for you. If prescribed, your medication ships directly to you for free in a discreet package. No waiting rooms, no pharmacy visits, and no insurance is needed. Plus, you can manage your plan directly on the Hims app. You can track progress and learn more about your conditions and how to treat them from leading medical experts. If you or a loved one has been struggling with ED, I really want to encourage you to go check out Hims. I know ED often has a psychological component to it as well. So be sure that you're stacking some psychological best practices into your daily routine. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/findingmastery. That's hims, hims.com/findingmastery for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/findingmastery. Disclaimer, hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Now, this week's conversation is with Cal Newport. He's an associate professor of computer science at Georgetown University, where he specializes in the theory of distributed systems. So Cal is also a New York Times bestselling author who writes about the intersection of technology and culture, and is the author of 7 books, including 2 that I bet you've heard of, Digital Minimalism, and then the other one, Deep Work, which have been published in over 30 languages. And his latest book is titled A World Without Email. And when I first read that title, I was like, oh my God, what are we doing here? And so, because I would love a world without email. I feel inundated by it. I struggle with my email. And so I have a good system for it now, but sometimes, you know, it just gets a little wild. And so he makes the case that our current approach to work is broken. And then he lays out a series of principles and concrete instructions for fixing what's broken. And that sets the tone for this conversation. We discuss how the modern work ecosystem has created the hyperactive hive mind, where everyone just grabs anyone as needed. And that's part and parcel of some of the, you know, the technology features that are in place where you can just ping somebody at will. But also it's this anxiety that sits underneath that I need to get something done now. And then the entitlement or narcissism that sits with that, which is like, well, I don't care what you're doing. I need that. And my needs are more important than anyone else's. And so as Cal puts it, it's convenient and flexible, but it's melting our brains and it's burning us out. So I highly recommend checking out Cal's new book and any of his other books for that matter. And now let's jump right into this conversation with the legend, Cal Newport. Cal, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm excited to be on the show.
Thank you. You're a pretty intense person. I can tell already. You are a serious human. You think deeply, evidenced by one of your books, Deep Work. But when I double click under there, like, how are you? What does that mean to you when you think, like, how really am I?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, is all cylinders of your life firing properly is probably the way I think about it. Not is it all going well, but in the different areas of your life that are important, are you getting after it in those areas in ways that you're happy about? And because for me, not doing well, if the answer is not so well, or overwhelmed, or the dreaded busy, that usually means one of those areas is getting neglected, one of the areas I'm getting slammed in, and that's when I'm not okay.
Is that off-the-cuff response, or is that something you've thought about, that's what I'm doing well means?
You know, I've started thinking about it in more explicit terms since the pandemic started. So I started a podcast during the pandemic, and I thought I would be talking mainly about the sort of world of business type advice I'm known for with like Deep Work or with A World Without Email. And just because of the nature of the day, the nature of the world, I found myself developing and talking a lot. We called it on the show, the buckets that make up the deep life. And I found myself talking about this term, the deep life, a lot, and talking about the different areas of your life and how you service each of these areas of your life. I hadn't been writing about that before. It's not in my books. It just felt like a natural reaction to what was going on into the world. So in some sense, yeah, it is something I've thought through, but it's something I've thought through since March. And you go before that, I don't think I had the vocabulary for it.
Yeah, I think that is true for anyone who's on the innovation kind of, I don't want to say frontier, but in that space of trying to figure things out. And then there's a forcing function, where it's environmental or cultural or political or performance-based. And there's a forcing function. It goes, woo, okay, how do I think about life or myself or others or my craft? And it sounds like for a contemplative, introspective human that you are, that you said, yeah, what are the big buckets? When we strip this back, what are the big buckets? And so your work is really about being present. And actually, that's what I take your work to be about. And I'm going to share that with you because that is my life purpose, to help others live in the present moment more often. That is my entire life purpose, dude. So your work is eloquent to that purpose and passion. So I'm excited for the conversation. I'm excited to meet you and better understand some of the insights and practices that have been important for you and understand where you learned them as well. So can I start kind of right out the gate on, you know, your new book? And email is a problem for me. Okay. I'm not the first person to say that to you. I know that, you know, it mm-hmm. was probably a problem for you too. So I want to set a little bit of context, Cal, is that our company is a mindful company. Okay. Finding Mastery is a mindful company. We meditate once a week together. Everybody's got their Great. Practices that we're supporting because we understand the value of both insight and wisdom and being fully present so that you can express your craft, your genius, whatever it might be. Okay. Now, I got texts pinging. We got emails flying. We got communication platforms that are zipping and binging and the whole thing, you know, Teams and Slack and whatever. And we're trying to solve things as fast as we possibly can with each other. We need each other. It's a full-on ecosystem that we're in. Now, I read your work and I go, how? I want you to say, okay, Mike, here's best practices to solve what it is that you and people just like you, just about everyone in the business world, is trying to figure out. So I'm sharing with you. I'm in it, dude. And I'm yep. stoked to have this conversation with you. I'm going to stop talking. Let her rip.
It's time for me to solve all your email problems. Yeah. Well, that's the idea. I mean, but let me say, it goes all the way back to 2016. This book goes all the way back to 2016. You know, so I had just published Deep Work at that point. And, you know, Deep Work was really much more about, let's not forget the value of focused effort, right? That when you're concentrating on something intensely without switching your attention and looking at email and looking at the internet, looking at your phone, you produce much more value, the type of value that moves the needle. We've kind of forgotten this. We're too busy and distracted. But that book just basically said, you know, we're distracted because of things like email. Like, you should make sure that you're not too distracted by it. Now let's get into why, and let's talk about how to train your ability to focus. Almost immediately after that book came out, I'm really talking to people. They're asking the question, I'm asking the question, like, but why are we so distracted? Like, why do we work this way? Why is it so hard when people read a book like Deep Work? Like, oh yeah, we should have much more unbroken time. And then they fail to get it. Like, what's going on? And that created this four-year quest to try to understand, why do we work this way? And is something else possible? And the sort of the high level bit I want to give, the bit that sort of is the foundation for the rest of any conversation on this topic, is that the key to all of these issues is you have to go below the level of behavior and down to workflow. I think the biggest problem people have when they look at their life right now and say, Slack owns my life. You know, my inbox owns my life. As they see a book like A World Without Email, they just think, without changing anything else, if I just stopped using email and Slack, it would be a disaster. This is how all of this work happens. This is how we coordinate. This is how we talk to clients. I can't not use it. This is how we use it. And the whole point of this book is like, yes, because underneath that, you've implicitly chosen a workflow that I call the hyperactive hive mind, but a workflow based on unstructured, ad hoc, back and forth conversation is the main organizing principle. There's an underlying workflow that's been implicitly decided on that makes all that email and Slack use unavoidable. And if you want to solve it, you can't stay at the surface. Like, well, let's change our norms and our etiquette and have some rules and have better expectations about responses and have email-free Fridays. And that's at the surface. It's not going to fix the problem. Eventually, you have to go down and look at the underlying workflow and say, this hyperactive hive mind where everyone just grabs anyone as needed is convenient and it's flexible, but it's melting our brains and it's burning us out. We're probably going to have to replace this with other workflows that still get the work done, but in a way that much more respects how our brain actually operates. So we have to kind of drill deep, and we have to get below the level of hacks, and we have to get below the level of norms and etiquette and get down to the basic question of, what are the core processes of your business? How does information come in and out of them? can we optimize it?
I love the phraseology, you know, uninterrupted time. Blocking that out to have deep work take place is a disruptive thought, not for athletes, because that's kind of how it works. And I don't think it's a now, based on your work and Eric Erickson, and in some respects, other authors, like, you know, the importance of deliberate, focused, deep work is well understood, but hard to create the space to do it, because what you're just saying is the hyperactive, what did you call it? Hyperactive?
Hive mind.
Hive mind. That's my company. That's it. It's actually,
yeah.
It's actually how sport works too. So there is deep work, but when an athlete or a group of athletes are doing something, best coaching, gold standard coaching, is to get feedback loops as tight as possible. So yeah. When you see something that's good, if you can give a feedback, if you see something in an error or a tweak, you give it as fast as possible. And sometimes you don't give any feedback because that's appropriate too. But as a general gold standard is a bit of that hyper focused interruption at some point. So yeah. I noticed that now for the first time, that that is something that spreads into my business culture as well. All right, brilliant. So you've got an audience that says, I understand the theory you're working from. I understand why it's a best practice, because, and maybe I'll stop talking, but you talk about why it's a best practice. And then I want to double click, like, all right, you got me on workflow and work streams. Probably, what are some solutions that you found to be valuable? But can you talk about why, let's start with the underlying principle, why deep work is so important, because that sits at the center, I think, of, you know, imagining a world without emails.
Right. I mean, this is the first part of the book. It's part one, part two solutions. Part one is, I call it the case against email. Let's get our hands dirty in all of the scientific literature. I think it's the first time that anyone has pulled together all of these different threads into one place where, first of all, I looked at all of the information we have about how do we use tools like email and Slack. What's the reality? What does the data show? How often are we looking at it? What is the context switching rate? Then I got into the neuroscience and the performance psychology of what happens to the brain when you have to check channels that much. Both of the answers are grim. The answer to the first question is it's all the time. It's all the time. And there's a ton of different data sources. The one I like the best comes from a company called Rescue Time, because they have software that tracks all of your apps on your computer. And they had all this data coming in from tens of thousands of knowledge workers about what they were doing on their computer. And so they hired some serious data scientist and say, have at it. It's a beautiful data set. In fact, I ended up actually connecting them with some pretty famous scientists I was interviewing, because those scientists were salivating about, I want that data set. They found on average, their users were checking an inbox, so Slack or email, once every 6 minutes. And, you know, that includes, they were not trying to take out like other ethnographic studies where they actually would put observers in the office to watch you at your computer screen. They would take out like meetings or lunch or times where you couldn't check it. This includes periods where like you're talking to someone and you couldn't check it. It's once every 6 minutes. Look at the research on what that does. It's devastating for the human mind. The human mind cannot context switch efficiently. There's a lot of work that happens when you take your semantic networks that are all primed to be thinking about a memo, and then you shift over to an email inbox and expose yourself, the worst case scenario from a context switching perspective, to dozens and dozens of unresolved, socially charged obligations. Some people who need things from you, completely different things to when you're working on, expectations being set. You see it all without resolving most of it. You try to turn your attention back to the memo. Your mind is now in a complete cognitive gridlock. It tried to start switching over to this, then you tried to wrench it back, and your performance drops, your ability to think drops. It makes you anxious. It exhausts you from a cognitive perspective. We cannot do those type of fast shifts. So the biggest problem with the hive mind is that it requires you to do parallel processing, that your main work and monitoring all these ongoing asynchronous, ad hoc, unstructured conversations. You have to keep monitoring back and forth, because if you don't, it all falls apart. This is how coordination happens. And it just devastates our mind. And so I'm not surprised that the hive mind is very popular, because it's incredibly natural. When you don't have a lot of objectives and you don't have a lot of people, it's how we naturally coordinate, right? So if there is five of us on a basketball court, or we're an offensive line in a football field. There's a group of us working on one objective. There's not that many of us. You know, we are going to coordinate ad hoc, unstructured, on the fly. You go there, watch for that, watch their point in audible, whatever. In the Paleolithic, this is how we would hunt a mammoth. You go that way, I'll go this way. It's how humans do it. But when you scale this up to, well, there's 15 or 16 different types of things happening with our company, and now I'm trying to switch back and forth and service all of these, and there's 20 people now who are connected to the same email system, not just three, it doesn't scale. And so it's incredibly natural. There's a reason why it became the default, but it just simply doesn't scale when you get to the level, the number of objectives and the number of people involved in knowledge work. It just melts our brains. It's not a tenable way to coordinate brains to produce value.
Okay, I want to talk to you about a new sponsor right here, Hydro. I love what they're doing. They are awesome. I don't know if you're into rowing like I am. I really enjoy it. What I try to do is I try to move around different cardio exercises. Sometimes on a bike, sometimes I'm rowing, sometimes I'm outside. But when I want to row, they've got it dialed in. They've done something fundamentally different than all the other rowers. One, it's not this loud machine that is making a ton of noise and, you know, chains slapping all over the place. They've done this in a really slick, premium, elevated way. And then the other thing they've done is that there's a nice screen that you can have a guide or a coach with you. And their coaches are Olympians and world-class athletes. And what they've done is they're filming, full stop, they are filming all over the world on places where their experts are rowing, and then you get to go with them. And they're coaching you the whole way. I love it. My favorite coach by far is Mac. She's great. And I just want to encourage you to give them a shot. If you love rowing, I think you're going to love this machine. And if you're not into rowing, I don't know if you know this, but rowing, there's been some research around rowing that rowing engages over 80% of your muscles while you're doing it. So it's a really efficient exercise. This spring, join the growing rowing community at Hydro. Head over to Hydro.com and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's Hydro.com, Hydrow.com, and use the code MASTERY to save up to $400. Hydro.com, use the code MASTERY. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AG1. It's really important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for almost a decade now, I've been drinking AG1. When I first was connected with them, I thought, oh, this is great. This is great. And then I double-clicked to understand their process and how they went about it. And I just love the rigor that goes into what they're creating and the product that they have. And they've gone through so many iterations to get it just right, 52 of them to be exact. Sometimes quality can be a buzzword, but they are committed. They are fundamentally committed to have a great product for us. They're interested in absorption. They're interested in high quality manufacturing. They rigorously test their product. So I trust what's in AG1. And one of the reasons I have extra confidence in that statement is they are NSF certified for sport. That's one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. They've made it so easy as well. What I do every morning is I take a scoop, put it into a cup of water, shake it up, and it's the first thing that I put in my stomach. And I love it. It just gives me the sense like, okay, I've invested in my health and I haven't even started my day yet. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, I want to encourage you to go check out AG1. So try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3, K2, and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/findingmastery. Again, that's drinkag1.com/findingmastery. I hope you will check them out. One of the upsides of the hive mind is that we are able to get something quickly when we need it. And it's a bit dismissive to the other person's genius or accessing their genius, right? You're saying, hey, I know you might be in the middle of something that's deep and rich and could be a game-changing whatever, but I need this document now. But sometimes you need the document now. And so how do you solve that?
Well, all of my solutions go back to this fundamental idea that you have to replace the hive mind. You have to say, what do we do instead? If you don't say what we're going to do instead, you're going to have a problem. So you have to identify what are the different processes that are relevant to our organization. Like we have a process here about servicing client inquiries. We have a process here that's about production, right? Making sure that the podcast episodes, you know, the Finding Mastery podcast episodes get produced and on there in time. We have a process about dealing with sponsors. We have a process about contracts and this and that. You might not have named them. You may have never thought about them, but they all exist. And right now, most processes in most organizations, especially small to mid-sized ones, just unfold in the hive mind. Like, we'll just work it out on the fly. I'll grab you as I need you. You grab me. We'll just rock and roll, right? If you don't want to do that, you actually have to think through each of these processes. And I give endless case studies in the book.
You do. And they're great. You're very concrete. And it's one of the things I appreciate about your work is that you are a systemic thinker. Like, you think across systems. So you're a systems thinker, not systemic, systems thinker, but then you dive down into practical solutions. So you found that unique blend that is hard for many. And I'm guessing you're an introvert, but I don't know that.
Yeah, I think I am, in the sense that I don't crave being, I get exhausted, I guess, like if I'm at a conference and having to talk to a lot of people. But on the other hand, I'm kind of realizing in this pandemic, I miss people. I like being around people. So I don't know. I would have normally characterized myself as an introvert, but an introvert who just really likes people, if that's possible.
Oh, no. Yeah. Let's double click on that, because I think it's a misnomer a bit, introversion, extroversion. And so in the worst case, we tend to think that an introvert is shy. That's not true. And yeah. An extrovert is just gregarious, the outgoing, likable. That's not true. You can be an extrovert and not like people. It's a bit of a crisis, you know. But introversion is, how do you gather energy?
Yeah.
Do you gather from thinking and feeling and mulling something and grokking with something? Is that how you gather energy? And you can get that from one-on-one conversations, one-on-two conversations. Yeah. And then when an introvert speaks, pay attention, because I thought about it. They don't change their mind on the whim like us crazy extroverts. So extroverts will be in a conversation, and how do you know that they're thinking? Because they're moving their lips. And they'll change their mind three times, and the introvert goes, "Will you just fuck, what are you doing? Like, you just said this 30 seconds ago, the exact, you know." So there's the crazy making tension. But really, intro and extroversion is about, how do you gather energy? And so hopefully you're an introvert that likes people. It makes for a nice EQ, social IQ, whatever, that can blend together. It sounds like that, because the reason I say that, Cal, is because you're waving the flag that all the introverts on my team wave, but they don't have the solution that you have, and nor do I have the solution that you have. And so open office spaces is actually like the worst thing you could do for an introvert. And it's actually, in your mind, probably one of the greatest constrictors to deep work and deep output.
Yeah, it was a weird movement. I mean, the best research I saw on it, I think this was Alex Pentland's lab at MIT, is they put these meters on people. So you could actually detect quantitatively, are you talking to someone? And the paradox of open offices, they're bad for extroverts too, because the amount of person-to-person interaction goes down. And it goes down because people are worried about bothering other people. It's this weird paradox of open office. Like, oh, if we're all in the same space, we'll like grab each other and have all these ideas and it'll be serendipitous. People send more emails and talk to each other less because they think it's rude. Because now if I'm talking, I'm interrupting 20 people who are nearby. So it's just a disaster for everybody. So I understand why they do it. But the reason why we did open offices, it's a signaling thing. It signals to investors and employees that you're disruptive, and that shouldn't be dismissed, because you need good employees and you need investment. So it's not like they were irrational, but they don't have they're not in any way about making employees more productive or more creative or more effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Okay. Cal, why'd you get into this work? You know, were you frustrated? Were you the frustrated introvert that couldn't get shit done? Like, what brought you, of all the things that you could research, why did you go down this path?
I was frustrated. It was a convergence of my frustration plus a trajectory of writing that had started years earlier. So, you know, I wrote a book in 2012 called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And I wrote this when I was in my 20s. And it was about career advice. And it had this premise about whatever, we put too much emphasis on pre-existing passion and not enough emphasis on building rare and valuable skills. And there was this natural follow-up question to that, which was, well, how do I build rare and valuable skills? And you know, at this point, I had been training at the theory group at MIT, and I was now a young professor, and I'm a theoretician. So in my world, I'm very familiar with focus as like a tier one skill people talk about. And so that led to deep work. I was like, well, now that I really think about it, focusing without distraction, that's really valuable. If you want to get really good at something, you want to learn hard things. I mean, every athlete knows this. You're going to have to deliberately practice. You got to focus. Focus is good. We don't value focus enough. That was deep work. And then deep work comes out and people are like, I can't do it. It's crazy. All I'm doing is email. All I'm doing is Slack. It's like the unsolvable problem. And I was starting to feel the same thing, because now I'm no longer a grad student at MIT that's just staring at whiteboards all day and it's awesome. I'm a faculty member and I'm getting emailed by deans and by assistants and by students. And so I was feeling that pain too. And so those came together and I was like, well, what is going on here? Why are we doing this? Who decided that this was, is this the only way to work? Like it has to be constant ongoing conversation. Where did that come from? Those two interests came together and it was like, you know, explosion. Like, okay, this is a huge topic. It affects an entire sector of our economy. It affects hundreds of billions of dollars of GDP. It affects millions of people's satisfaction with their everyday life. It just was one of those things where once I realized how big of a topic this was, I was on it for years after that.
Got it. Makes sense. I think you could take the word deep work just for a moment and call it meditation. Because in many respects, meditation is deep work, you know, like what it stands for, like deep emotional work, but it's also deeply focused work. And I don't know if you meditate or have mindfulness practice, but the idea of working with internal stimulus and external stimulus as well, and working with those two to be able to come back to the central thing that you're focusing on, to eventually get to insight, to eventually get to wisdom, to eventually get to some sort of freedom that you can play in present moments, as opposed to be beholden by the whip's end of what stimulus is actually driving your attention. And do you have a mindfulness practice?
I have off and on, and I'm pretty familiar with it and do find it to be very intertwined with professional focus depth.
Yeah, and I'm not suggesting that your book is about that, but just as a corollary, an easy corollary that jumps right out at the brilliant title that you have. And then the double click underneath that for me is that there are so many ways to train focus. And the way that I think about it is actually, I want to sharpen this concept just a little bit, and I want to give space for you to add here, is that we're actually not training focus, we're training refocus. So focusing is a decision. And once your attention is grabbed, and a weak mind, I'm going to be almost, I'm going to be obtuse here, but maybe disrespectful to the complexity of how complicated this is. But if your mind is really undisciplined and the shiny bell rings and you can't help yourself but to be attracted to the shiny bell, then entertain the shiny bell when you know you've got something else you should be entertaining, or that would be more useful to entertain, that's kind of, let's call it weak for just a moment. Not, I understand that I'm not being kind to the way that the mind works. That being said, the idea that we train refocus is actually at the heart of it. Like once your mind wanders, how do you bring it back? And that for me is a game-changing concept. I'd love if you could share some of your insights on how to help people be more focused. And maybe if you use that word, by training refocus.
Well, I think refocus is at the core of being good at focused. And in fact, one of the methods back in my book, Deep Work, and one of the methods I talked about took the main mechanisms, and I almost feel blasphemous doing this, like the Dalai Lama is going to come yell at me.
I just had that same thing in my mind the last 30 seconds. So you and I are in the same place, like trying to oversimplify something that's beautiful and complicated.
Yeah, there's a monk crying somewhere as they listen to this. Yes. but I have had mindfulness practices off and on. I'm familiar with it. I'm familiar with, I was a real sort of follower of Jon Kabat-Zinn for a while, for example. And I took the core mechanism of mindfulness meditation, the noticing of the attention wandering and without judgment, bringing it back. And then I melded it with a professional training exercise that I called it productive meditation, but it's very, very effective. And what you do is you go for a walk because walking, you know, for whatever reason, it silences some parts of your brain. It makes certain things better. And in this exercise, you have one professional problem. You know, okay, I want to make progress on this professional thing. And of course, your mind's going to wander. It's going to be all over the place. It's going to think about emails you have to write. It's going to think about what's coming up. And you deploy the mindfulness meditation thing again and again. You notice it, bring it back to the problem. Notice it, bring it back to the problem. That particular exercise turns out to be very, very effective for rapidly increasing the people's ability to focus on professional tasks. And if you think about it, what is that exercise? It's refocus training. All you're doing is, I want to practice refocusing, but in the very specific context of I'm thinking about something relevant to my work. And so I'm getting refocus practice exactly in the setting in which I'm going to want to apply it. And maybe for that reason, it's very effective for people.
Okay. So if we put it into some sort of steps, you make a commitment to go for a walk. And would you time bound that? Because there is some thoughts that, you know, our cognitive load benefits from breaks, but I'll see if you put a time bound on it. But so you go for a walk, and then you establish a challenge or a problem that you're trying to sort out. And then while you're walking, your mind is wandering, jumping over to all the different stimulus or internal ideas. And then you say, oh, wait, I caught it. Come on back. Solve this problem. And then wanders again. Solve. Wait, hold on. Come back and solve the problem while you're walking.
Yeah.
And then would you put a time, would you time bound it?
Not usually. Usually I would have, I would have a route. So I did this for 2 years daily. It was during the 2 years when I was a postdoc also at MIT. During that period, I lived 1 mile from campus. And so I would walk to campus at a very scenic, you know, Boston over the Longfellow Bridge across the Charles or whatever. I'd walk to campus, I'd walk back. And so I used one of those walks. So that would have been, you know, 20 minutes or something like this, depending on the route I took. And that would be that. And so it'd be 10 to 20 minutes. And it's very, very hard at first. You just like with a new mindfulness meditation practice, you go all over the place, you get better at it and you get really good. I mean, by the time I was done with this, I can write book chapters in my head. I do a lot of work on mathematical proofs in my head. All of this stuff is trainable. The crazy thing is that almost no one trains it. Like in athletics, it'd be crazy if you're like, oh, I know it's important to have good lungs, right? I'm playing basketball or something, but I don't train cardio. You know, like I don't try to do anything to make it better. And if you're a knowledge worker or you're a creative worker, I mean, concentrating on one thing is like your equivalent of having good cardiovascular health. It's like crucial to what you do, but we just think of it as like for some reason we think of focus as this like intrinsic trait that some people are just good at and other people aren't. And you're like, oh, I guess I'm not a focus person. That's like, if I went out and ran a mile, if I've never done any running, it would be wrong for me to conclude, oh, I'm not a running person. It would be, no, I'm not trained to run. I got to lace up the shoes.
I think there's probably two things, and I'll share a sport analogy in a second, is that ADD, ADHD, you know, there's a biological component to it, best we think. And so there are some people that use the running analogy for a minute. Maybe they've got smaller lungs or less efficient kind of lungs, you know, and maybe it's true that person from a genetic standpoint is not best served for anything distance. I've raised my hand. That is me. I'm more of a sprinter than a long distance person from a genetic standpoint. And I say that because I've had that tested, you know, and so that's a fun dialogue if you haven't done it. And then, so there's that, but then there's the other is that it's intangible. It's hard to put your arms around how to focus and how to train it. To our conversation here, it's so important because I've heard for years coaches say, ah, he just lost his focus. Or they'll walk over to an athlete before they're going on the field and say, hey, focus in now. How? What do you mean? Yeah, I'm trying my best, you know, but it's not a capability that's been developed or purposely developed. So this is the pushback I get when I talk in similar ways that you and I are talking about the importance of focus, and they say, wait, what do you think practice is? When we're practicing and we're practicing at full speed, the athlete has to be focused. So we're getting deep focused work for 20 minutes at a time, you know, 10 minutes at a time for 4 hours a day. Like, Mike, that's pretty good, don't you think? And then for me to build a case otherwise becomes a longer discussion. And so how would you initially have that knee-jerk response when they say, listen, try to catch a ball with someone trying to knock your head off at, you know, 22 miles an hour. in the open field. Like, you have to be focused, Mike. That's what practice is. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, you mean, so like, if I'm, you're talking about athletes in particular here.
I am.
It's, yeah, so, which is very interesting, because one of the groups that I have quite a bit of interaction with is professional athletics. I mean, without giving away specific names, I've talked with general managers, I've talked with head coaches, I've talked with front and back office people, I've talked with athletes from the NBA, from MLB, from rugby, the main rugby league over in the UK, the PGA. I mean, Rory McIlroy at the Masters 2 years ago at his press conference was talking about my books as, you know, this was part of the training he was doing to prepare. So they care a lot about this. They care a lot about focus.
A lot.
They know, yes, it's really important. And one of the things they're realizing, and there's a lesson for all of us, is one of the things they're realizing is that, like other parts of health, your general behavior matters. And so let's say you're in a sport where the athletes are young, like the NBA. Like, yeah, when I'm on the court, I'm super focused, right? But if you're young, that means you've grown up with a smartphone in your hand. And you're on that phone every minute that you're not in practice. You're on that phone in the locker room. And I've talked with GMs that after, you know, have gone through and banned phones from the locker room for exactly this purpose, just to help, you know, people get their head in the game. You're on it late at night, you're constantly on there, you're constantly interacting. We're starting to realize that's the equivalent of an athlete that says, hey man, I run those wind sprints hard when I'm in practice, but yeah, after practice I smoke, you know, yeah, I eat some junk food. Like, no, your whole health matters even when you're not in practice. That's the thing I'm starting to see come into professional athletics, is your cognitive health matters. Those epsilons make all of the difference at the elite level. And so how you treat your mind outside of just being in practice or in the games really matters. If you're on your phone all the time, you're going to be have a weaker focus muscle when it's time to be on the court. And so I think this type of awareness is just starting to percolate up, that like, we don't know a lot about mental focus and training it, but I think we're just starting to realize in athletics and in business. I mean, high stakes business, they already know this. Fund managers who where mistakes can be millions and millions of dollars, they train their ability to focus like athletes train their muscle. So it's starting to percolate, but it's like a new frontier in performance.
You're right on the cusp of it. That's right on, dude. And you used an interesting word, epsilon, as opposed to delta. Most of the times we talk about delta, but you didn't. So can you explain why you chose that word?
Well, now this may just be my math geek showing, right? So I'm a theoretical computer scientist, and I work with optimization algorithms sometimes, and it's the terminology we often use when there's like a very small gap away from a particular function or a particular value, we tend to use epsilon. And so when I say epsilon, what I'm capturing is that, like, okay, it's a small gap off optimal is how we think about it in computer science. But obviously if you're doing athletics at an elite level, it's all in the small gaps.
Finding Master is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. By now, you're probably well aware that I am a huge fan of what they're doing. I love what they're building and how they're using science-backed technology to help people flourish. This is just a great technology that isn't measuring something. It's actually providing a state change for you to help you either downregulate, find a deeper sense of calm, maybe fall asleep a little bit easier. And if you want to be bit more up and animated, they've got a way to help you do that as well. It's awesome. It works by sending silent, soothing vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, of course. That's fun. And it's like music that you can just feel. Just like music, higher vibrations help improve your energy and focus, while lower vibrations, slower vibrations, help to reduce stress, help you relax. I use it twice a day. I use it after I do something really intense. So after it's a lift, after some fitness, after some sport, or after something I'm doing in the office. And I use it right before I go to bed. The science that they've found is fascinating. Across various real world and clinical trials, Apollo wearable users experience up to 40% less stress and feelings of anxiety. That's an average, of course. 19% more time in deep sleep, 11% increase in HRV, heart rate variability, and up to 25% more focus and concentration. Those are radical. And because you're a part of the Finding Mastery community, you're going to get an exclusive, and I mean that word here, 15% off an Apollo wearable. So just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer only available to Finding Mastery. I love that we get to do this together. So be sure to use our code. Again, APOLLONEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase. You're only getting that here. I really hope you'll check them out. Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, and I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTrue.com and enter the code FINDINGMASTERY at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there.
Okay, and I want to just hit this note because I think you and I almost feel like are two nerds about something deep and intangible. And I want to make it even as tangible as we possibly can, that this thing about focus, again, I'm going to say it again, it's really about refocus, but there is a physiological cost to multitasking. There is a cognitive load cost. And so when we're splitting our attention, we know that doesn't actually happen. It's to your point earlier, we're shifting from A to B. And in that shift, there's a cost.
Yes.
And it's expensive. And at the end of the day, or the end of the 40 minutes, or the end of the 10 minutes with lots of shifting, we become tired. And so you can use the kind of more colloquial willpower thing, but that's kind of what it feels like at the end of the day when there's a load, a cognitive load that has been heavier, that's been heavier than your ability and, or your capability, and that's taken place for an extended period of time. We kind of can call that chronic stress. And under chronic stress, there's an overall underwhelming or overwhelming subpar performance. So I just want to ground it. And maybe I made it more confusing, Cal. Like, wave me off if that, you know, seemed too esoteric, but.
No, I think that's right. That's right in it. And in fact, the only adjustment I would make just to make the message land even stronger is that I would get rid of the word multitasking, because I think people misunderstand that, or it's misapplied. I think when people think about multitasking, they think about literally doing the thing simultaneously, right? I'm on the phone while I'm writing. And yeah, the problem with that,
there's no such
thing. No one does that. Yeah. Yeah, no one does, but also no one does that anymore. Like, no one keeps the two windows open. And so they think they're doing a good job. And like, what I like to emphasize, the way I summarize what you just said, is the cost is in the context switch. The cost is in the switch, right? When you do a switch and then you switch back, that's what generates this cognitive drag. That's what puts in all the friction. So a lot of people more recently thought, I'm great. I don't multitask. I just have Microsoft Word open. I don't have other things open at the same time. They're like, well, yeah, every 10 or 15 minutes, I glance at Outlook, but only for a minute. And then I close it and I've turned off my notifications. I don't have notifications. I'm great. I have no notifications, not multitasking. What they don't realize is looking over at Outlook, even for a minute, and then coming back to it, you have caused a calamity in your brain, right? It's why everyone has this experience of if you're working on something and I run in and just say a nonsense word and then run out of the room, your attention has shifted. But there was nothing there to hook onto. There's no open loops. You weren't being exposed to new obligations. You weren't really switching your context. You can get right back into what you're doing. But if you read through an inbox and you see 20 new messages, most of which you can't answer, everyone has that experience of coming away from that just dragging. It's because you have just siphoned off so much mental energy that's like, oh, we got to worry about that. We got to worry about that. We got to worry about that. When you try to turn your attention back, you have these parts of your brain that are like, hey, wait a second. Like, someone here was asking us something. We can't ignore people, right? We're going to starve if we don't have good dyadic relationships with our tribe members. And this person needs something. Let's get going. And you know it's true because you're trying to get back to word and you find yourself daydreaming, writing email responses. How many times have you just written email responses in your head for no reason? That is poison for cognitive performance, is exposing yourself, switching your context to something that is unresolved, involves people needing things. It's diverse, it's different from what you're working on, and then it's trying to switch back. And I think that I'm very glad you hammered on it. That's like in a world without email, that's the whole case for why, no matter how convenient it is, and no matter how cheap and flexible it is to just put people on the common email server and rock and roll. It's very simple. You don't have to train anyone. You don't have to make processes. There's no hard edges. It's very convenient, and I get that. But it is such a drain and disaster for people's brains that it can't possibly be the right way to work.
Amen. And you might have your finger on this statistic. There was some research that I found that the average folk that engages in cognitive shifting X number of times per second or minute, that you can calculate the amount of time that's been wasted. Is that on the tip of your tongue by any chance? That number of minutes per 16-hour days?
I don't have the exact number, but I can tell you there's a research trajectory that goes all the way back, I uncovered, to the 1920s, where they first started doing these experiments where they have you do one task and they time it, and you do another task and you time it, and then they have you interleave the tasks.
That's the one.
And and they both take longer, and they obsessively measured this. So there's all sorts of numbers. Now, they were doing this originally just to try to figure out how the brain worked, because they didn't have imagery or anything back then in the 1920s. But we just have decades of data, and they got pretty obsessive about it. Like, well, what if the task is like this? It slows you down by this many seconds, and you could really get pretty nitpicky about it. But you can do the experiment yourself. I mean, even just counting and going backwards in the alphabet, and then trying to interleave those two things, like counting the evens plus ones, and then going backwards in the alphabet. Like, there's some things you can do very fast on its own. Try to interleave those, and you just immediately feel God, my brain is just collided, and now I can't do either of them as well.
So you've got a podcast and your book, A World Without Emails. I get this all the time. So I did an Audible original with Head Coach Pete Carroll. So it's a book, but in audio form only at this point. And I got a bunch of emails that would say, love it. Is it weird that I'm actually riding my bike and listening? Should I not be like listening to your podcast while I'm, you know, exercising? And, you know, so how do you answer that kind of efficiency stack that many people are trying to do?
I think this is one of the great advantages of podcast, is that I think what you're doing is you're reclaiming what would have historically been lost cognitive cycles. Like, when you're doing manual labor, when you're transiting from one point to another point, you're mowing the yard, you're commuting, you're waiting in line at the pharmacy, those were often lost cognitive time, and this gives you something to do with it. The only caveat I give people, and this came from another book I wrote, is you just want to make sure on a regular basis you get some time alone with just your own thoughts. Our brain needs it. I think of it like a vitamin. You don't want to take vitamin D all day long. You're going to get sick, but you don't want to have no vitamin D. So I call it vitamin solitude. You need to have a little bit of time every day where you do something where it's just you alone with your own thoughts. And at least once a week, I prescribe, do a significant thing, just you alone reflecting, a long walk or a bike ride or something like that. But outside of those doses of vitamin, whatever we want to call it, solitude, and if you have a mindfulness practice, you're on top of it, right? You're getting that. As long as you're getting that, I'm a big believer of like, yeah, so now I'm doing the dishes. Yeah, what a great time. Like, might as well, right? It's either this or I'm listening to music or whatever we used to do. And it's like, I'd kind of rather listen to someone interesting. So I'm on board with people listening to, they should be listening to Finding Mastery at every moment possible. How about that for a prescription?
Yeah, good. And then plug yours as well. It's too fun, man. I love this.
Yeah. Mine is Deep Questions, and it's my readers send in questions. And I just rock and roll. Like it's rarely do I have guests on. I just go hour and a half at a time, do a mini episode each week where there, you know, people call in. So it's, you can actually hear them talking, and we get into work and productivity. We get into focus, we get into technology, we get into deep life. It's just, that's been fun. It's a way of just covering a lot more material than I'm able. I can talk faster than I write.
Me too. And you know, sometimes I just want to add this note, and then I'm going to come back to deep questions, is that sometimes when you're washing the dishes, just wash the dishes, right? Sometimes just wash the dishes. And three things that I outline in my book is like, there's three ways people say all the time, like, okay, how do you get to these first principles that you talk about, your core philosophy in life? How do you get to your purpose and understand like that self-discovery stuff that is at the core of becoming? I say, okay, there's three ways that I know about, and I go into detail about it, but I think you might appreciate this because it laps right into your vitamin solitude. Is that how you called it?
Yeah.
Is mindfulness, writing, and conversations with wise people. And if you have some sort of that rhythm, and each day you're hitting some sort of that, one of those three processes, you're going to get there, you know, like, eventually it's going to become more clear to you. And I think that you're saying the same thing, like, hey, just build in some vitamin solitude every day. Not too much, but get some in, just like vitamin D. It's necessary.
Well, and not to interject, I just think it's a really important point. I mean, I'm someone who does ideas for a living. I think a lot of people underestimate the degree to which reflection is crucial to structure your experience and draw insight out of it. It's like the downtime your computer needs. You have to sit alone with your own thoughts and think about things, or you extract almost no value out of what's happening in your life. I mean, the amount of hours I have to spend to be a professional idea person thinking, that's like my wind sprints. That's like my drills, is I have to walk and think just hours and hours and hours, because there's no way I can get to the insights on which books are built or this is built. There's only one way to get there, and it's thought hours. Thinking. You got to structure your experience, build a structure around what you know, take things you've just learned, place them in the structure, see the structure doesn't quite work, adjust the structure, repeat, do that hundreds of hours. At the other end of that equation, you get wisdom.
I love it. So simple. And you know what? You are actually, you're stacking in an interesting way. Like you're using simulcasting to do some of your deep work. I imagine, I don't know, maybe you write before you do your podcast, but I'm actually imagining that your thoughts are pretty clear at this point about many of these topics. And so when someone fields a question to you, you look at them, you probably think about them over a walk. And then at some point you turn on the mic and you go, okay. And you probably like the little bit of the dopamine, serotonin, cortisol, adrenaline rush that you get of trying to find it and figure it out on the fly. Am I getting you right so far?
Yeah. The stuff I'm talking about, it's okay. Yeah. I've thought about that for 100 hours.
Yeah. 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 There you go. Yeah. That's cool for you. And that's in one respect why maybe both of us fired up a podcast, is because it gives that white space to be deeply immersed in a idea or a person or a concept. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Listen, Cal, I appreciate you. And I love how your mind works. It's simple, it's clear, it's thoughtful. And you're not looking for shortcuts and hacks and tricks. You know, it's none of that BS. And so I really appreciate the conscientiousness that you have towards making lives better and the way that you think about systems. And I want to ask a couple kind of final hits here. Knowing what you know, we could go two ways on this, Cal. We could go kind of more pessimistic or optimistic. But knowing what you know, what scares you about what is going to happen to us if we keep following the email fly-in, zing and texting and the whole thing? If we keep following the trajectory that we are on now, what do you think about our future? What scares you, concerns you?
I do have a few fears. One fear is the younger generation, because I think the technologies that impede any ability to get exposure to early exposure to focus, early exposure to time alone with your own thoughts, the technologies that impede that, like smartphones and all the software that comes with them. When you have a generation younger than me, I'm not too old, but I'm old enough. I didn't have any of this stuff before. I didn't have it in college. I didn't have it as a kid. I am worried about their fundamental foundation of concentration ability. And our economy, the knowledge sector of our economy, which is up to 50% of the US economy, is really dependent on brains. Eventually, brains have to transform information into value. And it's as if we were in ancient Sparta, where warfare was at the very core of our culture's success, and we had a generation coming up that was very out of shape. So I sometimes get worried about that. I don't think we talk or prioritize the ability to focus much. The other fear I have, and I don't think this is going to be borne out. I mean, one of the big ideas in the book is that this is all going to change because there's a profit imperative. It's a difficult phase change to get rid of the hive mind and replace with other processes, but people are working on it. And there's CEOs who think this is it. This is the big thing of the next 20 years. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars of increase in GDP. The changes are going to happen because there's too much money at stake. But if they don't happen fast enough, one thing I'm worried about as well is we're not seeing one of the potential consequences of AI, which is we like to think about automating work and the people whose work is being automated losing their jobs. Creative workers or high-level knowledge workers say, well, I'm safe from that because what I do can't be replaced by AI. And that might be true. But this hyperactive hive mind is so inefficient that we are leaving huge capacity on the table. And if we don't gradually move away from this, AI is fighting to get to a place where it can do it all at once. There's a huge amount of investment going into AI that basically means we would no longer have to have these email inboxes. We can each have our own digital chief of staff that talks to your chief of staff. It figures out what we need to be working on. It takes care of things for us. And it just isolates the stuff that humans do really well, right? Like here, just think about this, write about this, make this decision. I've gathered the information. You don't have to be on email. You don't have to be on Slack. This sounds great because it means you're going to get back all this capacity. The problem is if that happens all at once, we're not going to need nearly as many knowledge workers. If essentially overnight, we make all creative workers 50, 60, 70% more productive, the flip side of that is we might need 50, 60% less creatives. We might need less knowledge workers. If one professor can do the research it used to take three because they're not on email all day, maybe that department is as third as big. If a lawyer can write many more better briefs because they're not doing emails and billing emails on 6-minute increments, maybe you need one instead of three lawyers to handle a particular subspecialty. So that's another thing that worries me is that if we don't start changing this gradually so we can reassign these resources and grow our economy really large, I'm worried that AI could unexpectedly disrupt the knowledge or creative sectors in ways that we weren't waiting for or weren't really aware of.
Mm. That's cool. Okay. And if you had a magic wand, would you remove emails and Slack and those types of communication text functions? Would you remove them? Or would you say, no, we need to do better working with them?
I would remove them temporarily. I would want everyone to have the experience of the character who opens up a world without email. And there's this opening story about someone who arrives in DC, they're a political appointee, they have this big group and a computer virus hits their computers. The Department of Homeland Security comes in and says, we're taking all your computers, right? We have to take them, we have to investigate them. Oh, and by the way, security laws say you can't use personal email, you can't use your personal computers. And they, for 6 weeks, had to exist without email. And they learned so much, right? About like, okay, what would you do if you didn't have email? What would you do if you didn't have Slack? You would create new processes. You'd have more white space. There'd be a lot of things to be a lot better. Some things would be a huge pain. That was exactly the experience of this group. And then when it came back, you could say, ah, we can keep these processes in place. We can do it this way. We can keep email and Slack just for this. I think there'd be a ton of insight if I could wave a wand and everyone had to spend 1 month every year without the digital communication tools. I just think we would be so much more, our mind would be blown about the possibilities for how you could structure work, what workflows are possible, different ways of moving information around that's not just sending emails. I just think it would be great if we could all take a temporary break. And then when we bring it back, just bring it back in a much more intentional way, servicing much more optimized processes.
It's such a mind bender. Like I'm that person that if you put an apple pie and an apple in front of me, I know which one is more healthy. And I choose the apple pie more often. I want the apple. You know, not literally in my diet, I choose apples, but I'm choosing in your analogy, I'm choosing the apple pie. I'm choosing kind of the chaos of how I'm organizing things. So I'm taking away from this, like, okay, I'm going to make some fundamental changes. You know, I'm not sure I know exactly how to get there. So I'm going to take another pass at some of the solutions in your book. And I appreciate you. Like, thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. Hopefully we're making apple pie a little bit less fundamental in this metaphor.
I don't know where we just went. I love it. Okay, so where do you want people to follow your work and check out your books? And like, where's the best place to send folks?
Yeah, so I don't have any social media accounts because I'm a sort of a deep work zealot. But I have a website, calnewport.com, where you can find out about me and the books and get my, I write an article every week for a newsletter. And then there's my podcast if you want to hear this type of stuff in your ear each week. And that is called Deep Questions.
So good. Okay, brilliant. And I want to encourage people to go check out the book, check out the podcast, check out Deep Work as well, the previous book that you wrote. So I hope you're enjoying what you're doing. You're making a difference, and look forward to connecting with you soon.
Yeah, well, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest, no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well, think well, and keep exploring.